Thanks for having me over. You want to say your name?
Sure, it's a little easier if I do. Yep, so my name's Dada Naba Nilananda, but I usually call myself the monk dude because it's a lot easier for people to remember, and anyway, everybody in America kind of brands themselves, so that works.
That's good. How long after you got the name Naba Nilananda?
Not bad.
Before you, you know, came up with the monk dude?
Oh, a long, long time.
Oh, yeah.
I discovered marketing in America, and I've only been here for 5 years. I've had this name since 1983.
So. Nice. And that was, you already had a couple albums out by that time.
No, I recorded, I've been playing music since I was 4 years old.
Okay.
But I recorded my first album in 1984 in Australia.
Cool. We're here at this new property that's now kind of part of the Ananda Marga organization.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess for our listeners, you know, do you want to go into a little bit of history of that? Or
sure.
Yeah.
So Ananda Marga means the path of bliss. It's a yoga and meditation kind of movement. It's also a social service movement. So we very much believe in the idea of, you know, personal development and also serving the universe and that being in a kind of a balance. So this property is something that our members got together and purchased very recently. I think it was just last year. And we're just developing it into a retreat center. So, you know, I think by next spring we should be able to open up for small retreats. And we've got big plans to develop it into a larger retreat center where we'll run, of course, meditation and yoga retreats, but we want to take it beyond that. We want to have things on permaculture and alternative energy and community development and all kind of practical stuff as well.
Great. Is that your field, large field out there? Is that part of the property also?
Yeah, it's an 80-acre property, or 79 acres, so there's a lot of forest and we've got a big wetlands there and there's the big field and we've got a lot of space.
Great. Yeah, no, that looks like a great field ready for a lot of food.
Yeah, we could definitely cultivate here. There's plenty of water.
Yeah. No, it's good. You know, researching a little bit of P.R. Sakar, who goes by the other name, Sri Sri Anandamurti.
Anandamurti, yeah.
Yeah. You know, he had a pretty, you know, amazing life and of resistance and what, you know, creating this whole, I guess, new way.
Yeah, he started a movement. He started the Ananda Marga movement in 1955, which was the year I was born, so I kind of fitted into that pretty well. And he was from India. He grew up in Jamalpur, which is a fairly big town actually, in Bihar. And from early on, he was really into mysticism and meditation and spirituality. But the thing that kind of set him apart, if you like, from other spiritual teachers in India was his social vision. And he was regarded as quite a radical, because back in the 50s, he was talking about things like women's rights. In India, this was not exactly fashionable in those days. You know, ecology, cooperatives. He was very outspoken against corruption, both in the religious institutions, particularly the Hindu priesthood and so forth, and in government in India. And this made him very unpopular. So he became quite a controversial figure, and he was considered to be a revolutionary in all of this. And he was spent some years in jail, actually, but he was finally became clear, was acquitted of all these kind of charges that were trumped up and brought against him, and he was released from jail. But he was like a political prisoner for some years.
Right. That was, it's interesting that the name Gandhi, you know, I'm not up on my India history, but the Indira Gandhi government, he must have really upset them, because that was the trumped up charges. He had to wait for them to, I guess, fall or...
That's right. The Indira Gandhi, interesting, just something about the name. Indira Gandhi is no relative of Mahatma Gandhi. Her husband, from whom she got the name, was not related to Mahatma Gandhi, but she really played on the name, and that was part of the reason she, not just that she got elected, her son became the prime minister, and her daughter-in-law is the head of the Congress Party today. It's a dynasty. And her father was Nehru, who was the first Prime Minister of India.
Nehru, N-E-R-O?
Yes.
Ah, okay.
So, Nehru, N-E-R-U, sorry.
Okay.
N-E-R-N-E-H-R-U, I think.
Okay.
So the first Prime Minister of India after independence, 1949, was Nehru. He was a buddy of Mahatma Gandhi. They were political allies. His daughter became the next Prime Minister, and her son, Rajiv, became the next Prime Minister. So this is supposed to be a democracy, but it's not really like that. So there's a lot of corruption in government in India, and nowadays most people consider that to be the number one problem in India. And so if you confront that, you know, you take on people in power, you can get a lot of problems.
Wow, so 71, he was in prison for these trumped up charges, and then, in 73 is when, you know, they tried to start poisoning him, I guess.
That's right. I think it was 70, yeah, that's right. He was poisoned by the prison doctor, and then he went on a protest fast for 5 years. He was just taking one cup of liquid a day for 5 years most of the time. And while he was, I think one year or less than that after he was arrested, Indira Gandhi declared a state of emergency. That was because she was being, there was an attempt to impeach her because of corruption. And so she froze that process by using special powers as Prime Minister and declared a state of emergency. All political opposition were jailed. Tens of thousands of people were in jail, including many of our members, but all sorts of any opposition party members. And eventually in 1978, she had to end the state of emergency because it was a limited thing, and she was immediately voted out of office. And it was that year that our founder, Ananda Murthy, was finally acquitted and released.
And it's interesting, on his world tour, he wasn't allowed into America. He had to go to Jamaica to meet his followers. So were they also, like, I mean, word spreads, or what was America's reasoning behind?
Oh, yeah. The Indian government, especially during that emergency when they had total control, they put out all kinds of very negative propaganda against Ananda Marga and our founder through all their embassies throughout the world. And, of course, if a government wants information about some figure from another country, they'll go to the embassy. So there was a lot of that, and we had problems. But now in the US, I mean, we get funding from the government for our projects and so on and so forth, and you know, it's no longer, people have understood that
right.
It was very much distorted.
Wow. Yeah, some of his, earlier on, he was coming up with the Prout, the Progressive Utilization Theory, and EROS, Education, Relief, and Welfare sections. I guess these are the kind of cornerstones of this social work, I guess, that he developed.
Exactly. So Prout, you know, stands for Progressive Utilization Theory in English. In Sanskrit, it's a double acronym. It works in Sanskrit. It stands for Pragatashila Upayoga Tattva. So it means, the idea is, you could call it progressive socialism. It's like a kind of spiritual socialism. So it's taking the idea that essentially that the property of the universe, that the wealth of the physical world is something that we really should share, and it's based on the economic model of the family, essentially. That in a family, if somebody's struggling, the rest of the family takes care of them. And it's not that everybody has the same, but we take care of one another. And that's really the underlying model of the Prout economic model.
Which is interesting about, you know, sending the women to work in this country was sort of about breaking up the family in so many ways, or how can we tax the whole family unit, you know, so, you know.
And how can we create a tremendous artificial consumer need so that both parents have to work, and
right.
We see the,
and then we can get the kids into the daycare, and right. Then, you know, and then blah, 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 it goes on and on, but we'll jump ahead. So, you know, you wrote this book that seems very popular, Close Your Eyes and Open Your Mind, The Practical Guide to Spiritual Meditation. I guess, you know, there seems to be many, many, many books about the subject, but why, or when did you decide you felt like there needed to be another one?
It's a good question, because there are thousands of books on meditation. I wrote that book for my students because I teach a lot of students, particularly university students, and I needed a book that said exactly what I needed it to say as far as what I understand about meditation. And honestly, I couldn't find a book that filled that niche, if you like.
Right.
So even though there are many books on meditation, they're all different. And mine's perhaps more different than most because it does try to approach meditation not as a form of stress management or relaxation, which is the way that a lot of people view it nowadays, but really takes it as it was originally intended, as a spiritual practice, as a way of connecting to the higher self or inner self, and feeling that we are connected to one another as well. And it also looks at the kind of holistic development of the individual, looks at health, you know, physical health, mental health, spiritual health, and it also looks at our role in the world. So it's really a kind of a holistic book about meditation, and a lot of people seem to like it. It's used by our teachers all over the world. It's in 6-7 languages now, I think.
Well, you keep things light, or as I'm reading your blog from the monkdude.com, you know, you even tackle...
I'm sprung.
Yeah. No, you tackle, like, why is Facebook so addictive? And then the short answer is saber-toothed tigers, and you'll have to read the blog to maybe find out, unless you want to tell them more. But
I write a lot of humor. Well, there's a lot of humorous stuff in my blog, and I'm writing a comic novel at the moment.
Oh, yeah, a sci-fi comic novel. Yeah.
Science fiction, fantasy,
comedy. Do you want to give
comedy.
A little blurb of that?
Of course I do. Yeah, I know, this is my favorite subject. Tell me when to shut up.
All right.
If you can... But what I'm aiming for is Lord of the Rings, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Alice Through the Looking Glass, and the Bhagavad Gita all rolled into one. So that's my fantasy about what my book might be.
All right.
And it's a story set on Earth in the 14th century. An alien from another planet, where he's a student in a college for saints, messiahs, and world saviors, he's sent here as an emissary to save the world back in a few centuries ago. It's a lot of fun.
Nice. So it's a little bit of, like, you know, what would happen if Jesus returned? You know, we would, like, burn him at the stake and run him out of town and call him a hippie or whatever.
Yeah, he has a few problems.
Yeah. That's great. Well, I look forward to that, you know, and especially, I mean, I wanted you to sprinkle some Fred Allen Wolf on it.
They're very good at explaining the significance of physics in layperson's terms. You know, I'm like many of us, I guess I'm an amateur physics babbler, right? But he makes it very clear. He's a brilliant guy.
And also clear that, you know, as, what is it, Bohr says, if anyone says they understand quantum, they don't understand, no one understands it. And if I say that, and I discovered it, and therefore don't believe anyone that says they understand it. But is this your quote? Do not wait for inspiration before you meditate. Meditation generates inspiration. Each session is a noble effort to transcend the inertia of spiritual sleep and awaken. Is that yours?
I guess it is, yeah. I never thought of it as a quote, but that's from my book, yes.
Well, I constantly love the idea of you know, awakening, or, you know, one of my favorite quotes, I don't know who said it, is... as long as it's a daydream, no one will want to wake up. But once it becomes a nightmare, you know, ..
Yeah, right.
Do you feel like...
But true.
Yeah. Do you feel, you know, I mean, that is happening, or is that something that everyone's always said in all times?
Well, of course, human beings are famous for prophesying the end of the world and the advent of the new Messiah, and, you know, every 50 years or something. But no, I think these times are unique. If there's such a thing as more unique than any other, of course that doesn't make sense. But it's obvious. We are at a critical point where our highly developed intellect and resulting technology meet whatever level we are at morally and spiritually, and there's a mismatch. And so I think that creates a kind of a pressure for us to develop morally and spiritually. There's the crisis, if you like, that you know, the multiple crises that we're seeing in so many different ways, does create a sense of urgency. And if we respond to that in a creative way, that can become something very good.
And Yeah, as you know, how far, how much can we awaken? Like, what, you know, all, you know, Maya, all is Maya. You know, how far can you take this? You know, the world is an illusion. You know, metaphor slash. You know, and whose illusion is it? And you know, what happens when you awaken and piercing the veil? I'm really excited about all these like subjects that I feel like it all ties in.
Well, as far as I can, you know, very broadly speaking, this is a very simplistic way of looking at different worldviews, but. As far as I can see, there's three main ways of looking at the world philosophically. One is that it's based on matter, that matter is primary, and that's the materialist view, if you like. One is that the world is an illusion, which is a view that a lot of maybe mystics and philosophers said that, you know, the only what we experience in the mind, that's it, and that the world out there is some sort of hologram, kind of matrix style,
right,
if you like. But the philosophy of Tantra Yoga, which is the basis of Anandamarga philosophy, which is, as you can say, the oldest form of yoga from India, not to be confused with the erotic cult.
Right.
The philosophy of Tantra really takes a different approach to either of these. It really says that, okay, the world is changing. It's not. There's no permanent reality in the physical world or even the world of the mind, but it has a reality of its own. And we would say that rather than everything being an illusion or everything being matter, actually everything is consciousness and everything is divine. So this creates a difference in the way that we treat one another. Because if I think that you're an illusion, it doesn't matter what I do to you, or it doesn't matter if you seem to be suffering, because it's an illusion. And that's a problem, because it creates a disconnect, actually, between people, and it creates a disconnect from what I consider our real human feelings, our natural human feelings of compassion and empathy and concern. I think those feelings are there for a reason. So if we treat everything as divine, it means rather than thinking everything's an illusion so nothing matters, rather everything matters. And that's a worldview that I think is not only closer to the reality, it's better for us as a community. It's more, if people have that worldview, we're much more likely to treat one another better.
Yeah, and another favorite quote of this extreme conspiracy theorist man, David Icke, you know, infinite love is all there is, the rest is an illusion. And I think, you know, that seems, I always like that, because, you know, he'll start a book off with that and then go into this, you know, total, you know, deep into the, I don't know. The
well, he's a brilliant man. And when he speaks about spirituality, I find it tremendously inspiring. When he starts getting onto weird stuff that I find completely unbelievable, then I kind of wonder what's wrong, what's happening.
Yeah, well, that's what's exciting. I mean, you know, as you know, like, take it all with a grain of salt. But then, you know, I think if you like, oh, every couple of years I'll buy one of his books, and I'm like, wow, now I have to imagine that the moon is an artificial like spaceship, and that the programming is coming from Saturn. You know, and I think that's healthy to like just keep wrapping your head, like how much can you wrap your head around, you know, that it's just energy, and love either raises the energy or, you know, hate lowers it. Yeah, and like simple things like that. But back to what's so important, you know, what I was reading about Anandamarga is like, it's about the experience. And, you know, I guess that ties it in with the Buddhist tradition of just, you know, until you experience something, you know, don't believe it, or sit on a fence until you've sat on a fence.
Well, yeah, there's a saying in the Vedas, I think, that well, this is more about rationality, but it says if a sage says something that's irrational, then discard it. But even if a child says something that you feel is true, then you should accept it. But as far as understanding, self-understanding, what's real and what's not, yeah, meditation really is about experiencing for yourself what's within you, rather than reading it in a book. Because you're not going to read in any book what's inside you, because what's inside you is unique. And you might read in a book an attempt to describe some sort of universal truth, but it can never be more than an attempt. You know, Joseph Campbell puts it beautifully when he's talking about Buddha, and he says the first thing that Buddha was supposed to have said after he achieved nirvana was, this cannot be taught. And that I cannot communicate what I've experienced through words, or, you know, people have to experience it for themselves.
Where truth is, you know, never in the words, it's in the space between the words. Mm-hmm. Or that gets us to, I'm always interested in how people interpret the age old, you know, phrase, as above, so below, you know. So.
Oh, I love that concept. I mean, we find everywhere in the physical universe, we find that patterns are reflected on different levels. Ken Wilber's great at writing about this. He just calls them holons, H-O-L-O-N. I think it's a word I don't think he made it up, but it's one that nobody understands. So what he means by holons is kind of patterns that recur. For example, the obvious one in the physical world is the nucleus and the orbiting body. So the electron is kind of like that, though it's sort of shells of probability, really, not, you know, the version I was taught in school 30, 40 years ago. But, you know, it's a nucleus with orbiting bodies. So we have the Earth as a nucleus, the Moon orbits and satellites, and the Sun with orbiting bodies. The galaxy has a nucleus. And even the super galaxy clusters have a nucleus, etc. So that's like a holon pattern. And we see that reflected throughout nature, in the you know, the cross-section of a tree, you know, a starfish, I mean, all over the place. So that's just one example of as above, so below, in the physical world. In the mental world, a really nice kind of holon is the biblical quote says that God created man in his own image. Okay, now what does that actually mean? A literalistic interpretation would imply that God looks like a man. I think most educated people understand that makes no sense at all. So what is meant by that? It's speaking metaphorically. What I understand by it is that our self-awareness that makes us unique, and you could say sets us apart from animals, the fact that we can reflect on our own consciousness. Animals are conscious, but you could say that they don't realize that they're conscious. We can say, oh, I'm awake. That is a reflection of something universal, of God, if you like, of the consciousness of God. So we're like mini versions in the mind, not in the body, but our minds are reflections, or have a reflection of divine consciousness. And that's where we are, we're below and God's above, if you like. So I think it occurs in all sorts of ways.
Yeah, and then the more you look, the more you know, you know, there's more to see, I guess, as a, you know, this is the smallest thing, the nucleus in the atom. And then they're like, oh, there's the quark. And then there's the subparticle, you know, something, you know.
Well, if you read on my blog, there's a story about me traveling with my pet lion to a yoga ball planet. You can have a look at that one. And on the yoga ball in the living room, we realize it's a planet. We descend to the yoga ball planet. And we go there and we find a little village and we find a yoga studio. And in that yoga studio, there are yoga balls. And those yoga balls are also planets, and so on and so forth.
I was excited to see that you worked with David Allen. You know,
you've heard of David Allen.
Well, I'm a Soft Machine fan. You know, okay. I could never find the Gong records in the record store.
Oh,
so I don't
have
too many of those.
Gong were wonderful. And, you know, I was a big fan of Gong when I was 19. And then, just by meeting musicians, I met Harry Williamson, who was a keyboard player with Gong, and buddies with David Allen. And David Allen, of course, was a founding member of Gong and Soft Machine. So then I met David Allen. He came and played on one of my albums. He played a bit of glissando guitar, and he's a wonderful guy. Very, very funny. And he's a yogi, does meditation and yoga every day.
Great. Well, I mean, that whole movement, I mean, you know, of course it was going to intersect, or it's all coming out of maybe the same spot. I mean, even, you know, Interstellar Space by Pink Floyd, or, you know, Interstellar Overdrive, or, you know, Accept the Controls for the Heart of the Sun. And,
yeah. And Gong were on track to become really big. They were, you know, double billed with Pink Floyd on the same platform, but they kind of deliberately chose not to go more commercial because they kind of didn't like what they saw of that world. They told me a lot of stories about it, which were, you know, kind of heavy, about record companies actually plying artists with drugs deliberately to try and get them hooked on drugs so that they'd need the money so that they wouldn't just to blow off contracts and stuff like that.
That's it. Yeah, interesting. I mean, I and as a young fan of rock music, I would always kind of contemplate why the later records weren't as good as the early records, or I was like, that's so cool, the Beatles broke up at the height of their, you know, so that's, you know, the inside track is like, oh, they chose the path
sometimes,
less tread.
Sometimes it's like that.
Cool. Well, we'll pause that for now, but yeah, let's see. Dada Nabhan Neel Ananda, otherwise known as the Monk Dude. That's great. You learned marketing from America.
I'm beginning to.
Yeah, that's good. Well, you know, it sounds like you're doing good, playing lots of music and, yeah, having a good time and keeping the spirits high.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, and cool.